Hey, everybody. So coming up next is Steve Wozniak, who really needs no introduction, but in case you've been living in a cave the last 30 years, he could not be more influential in the creation of the personal computer, particularly all the work he did on the disk drive and everything else. He's involved with the Homebrew Computer Club. He's got some pretty interesting breakout stories to tell. Like, I don't even know what to say. He's the man. Like, without him, like, half of this city wouldn't be here, and half this industry wouldn't be here. So, Steve Wozniak.
Yeah, it's really good to be here. Oh, shock. Sorry, it's not really a shock. It was a joke I planned, but forgot to do. Well, you know, actually it's little known, but really the whole reason for Apple was probably at least half games, you know. So that was really the big motivation. And a lot of, you know, times you think, oh my gosh, got to design something, make a bunch of money, start a company. And all the Apple designs were really to make some products that I could have fun with for myself. Never ever an idea to start a company. I had other people pushing me into that. And there's like in life, you get different forces that give you rewards. There are extrinsic rewards of the type that you can see in people, like the salary, a title, a prestigious job, a nice-looking house, some real fancy clothing, a hot car. And those are all the rewards you can see, and a lot of people work for those things. But then there are the rewards that everyone comes up with in their own life, the things that you do on your own time when you don't have a reason to, you're not getting a grade in a class, you're not getting, it's not a job. Nobody knows you do it. It's just the thing you like to do in life. It might be something as simple as crossword puzzles or playing solitaire or whatever. And those are intrinsic rewards, and those are the ones that sometimes motivate us most strongly, the things we really always want to do in life. You know, the number of game players might be an example that it's just their thing in life, whether they talk about it or not. And if they ever get a chance to work for a game company, it's just great. Well, I kind of chose electronics and somehow lucked into computers before computers were ever around, discovered a couple articles here and there. I was way too shy to go out and research and explore and how do you learn these things, but I would stumble into little bits and pieces by accident. And that was that one area in my life that was just going to be the inside reward for me to learn about. And it's really funny because in sixth grade I told my dad, well, I'm going to be two things. I'm going to be an engineer first and a teacher second. And it was really funny because I asked my first son one time when he was kind of young, I said, do you have any idea what you might want to do in life, be in life? And he was, you know, pretty smart in his schools, but he said, I don't know what I'm going to be, but I'm sure going to play games. Well, by about sixth grade, I had somehow stumbled into a lot of pieces of technology because my father had connections with the early semiconductor companies at the very start of chips and got donations of transistors and diodes back when they cost about, you know, $20 for a transistor. And I had learned enough to design little gates and put some gates together to make logic. And so for my science fair project in sixth grade, it was a machine that could play a game. It was tic-tac-toe was the game. And tic-tac-toe, as we all know, is logic. If there's an X here and an O there, then your next X goes here. So a machine can be taught to play in a way that it will never lose. Tic-tac-toe is a game you can never lose, right? Am I right? Yeah. Actually, tic-tac-toe is not a game of logic, is what I wound up teaching kids in later years. Tic-tac-toe is a game of psychology. If you play the right way, you can beat somebody. And everybody in here saying, no, you can't beat me at tic-tac-toe. Almost everyone I ever make that challenge to, I can go beat. There is a way. There is a method. But that's besides the point. This game of tic-tac-toe in sixth grade had a 3-foot by 4-foot piece of plywood pounded in nails for the connectors. This was back before you could even buy any punch board, you know, connections for wiring stuff together. Soldered transistor leads, diode leads, resistor leads to make a gate for this and that. Take an X here, take this and that, take an X here, take an X here, take an X here. Tons and tons of little gates. It was a whole big logic thing. Took a long, long time to build because it was hundreds and hundreds, even of transistors, and twice as many diodes about, and, you know, tons of resistors. Took a long time to build. Didn't quite get it done in time for the science fair because, like, the night before, a bunch of them blew out, got the wrong voltage. But it was really a lot of fun. Now, you'd have to call, if you call that a game, player makes a move, the computer makes a move. The player makes a move, the computer. It's not a computer. It doesn't run a program. It was all hardwired logic. It was hardware. Every little wire had a meaning that was kind of like about one or two lines of programming code. Only nowadays it might be like 1 or 2,000 lines of programming code. But in high school, I got a chance to get close to a real computer by accident. I was so knowledgeable about electronics. My electronics teacher, excellent electronics teacher, wrote his own courseware, wrote the whole manual for us. The text had some great equipment in the electronics lab. How did we have so much great equipment in our high school when no other high school had this kind of a program? Well, in the early years of the high school, he would buy a Heath kits that were kind of cheap, build it yourself, and teach his students electronics in building 1 year a signal generator, another year an oscilloscope, another year some meters. So bit by bit, he built up this incredible class of hardware. Well, he said, Steve, you kind of know all the electronics here. I mean, I've been a ham radio operator from sixth grade on, actually. And he said, so I got these engineers outside of the school. That is so great when a teacher can somehow find a way to go beyond the limitations of a school. Most schools will say, we are the source of education and knowledge. Everyone gets it, and they get what we have here. But it's so great when occasionally a teacher can find things for an outside that will help somebody that can take advantage of it. He said, you can go down to Sylvania and program a computer. Oh, my God, I didn't even know computers were at companies like Sylvania. So I got a Fortran manual and learned Fortran, went down there and saw this machine where you could type in and create some cards and put the cards in and run a program, and an engineer was helping me out. The first program I tried to write was the Knight's Gambit, the Knight's Tour in chess, where a knight has to jump around the chessboard and hit every square exactly once with no duplications. So I said, well, I'll just start jumping. I'll just write the formulas to have the knight jump up two and over one and up two and over one and just keep jumping up till he gets hung up, and he'll back up and try a different path and back up and try a different path and back up. And so I wrote it, and the lights on his computer were it was an IBM 1170 or something like that, or 1370, just flickering and flickering and flickering and flickering and flickering, and nothing came out. And I was kind of, you know, can we wait a few more minutes? And nothing came out. So the engineer said, well, you probably have a loop in your program, you know. So I learned about loops. So the next week I went back and I designed it so I could flip a switch on this IBM computer and it would start printing out the chessboards it was working on. And I flipped the switch and it started printing out chessboards. And it was doing exactly what I had trained it. And then I went back and did a little calculation, and it was going to get a solution in 10 to the 25th years. So I guess that means that, you know, brute force, having a machine that can do a million things a second, isn't enough. You kind of have to have a good approach to things. First year at Colorado, you know, one thing about electronics and engineering is, you know, especially in those days, boy, you get Popular Electronics Magazine, build the kits, you do it all on your own. It's sort of like a real individual, independent thing. You can make things that other people don't make in this world and don't know about. You have this little bit of surprise. If you wrap a hair wire around a projector cord and when the teacher plugs it in, it blows up, you know what happened, and nobody else does in the class. Well, I went off to I had, you know, lots of electronics in pranks, just little noisemakers and sound generators and things like sirens in the driving simulation class and all that in school. But I went off to my first year of college, and one of the fun things that came about, you know, and fun is tied in with the whole idea of liking to play a lot of games. And, boy, we played a lot of Hearts and Bridge, you know, there all night long, you know, and then went off to a final. But I bought the fastest transistor they sold at Radio Shack in those days, you know, and it was rated something like 50 megahertz was all, but it was just enough, and made a little TV transmitter, little jammer. So I went to my dorm, oh boy, I tested on a couple friends' little black and white TVs, and it jammed them, and they knew me in my dorm. So I went over where they had a color TV. At night, there was one color TV, and it was in the basement of some girl's dorm, and we'd go over there, and I sat in the back row, and I had this little jammer with a 9-volt battery and a transistor and a couple parts and a little trimmer capacitor that I got out of an AM pocket radio in those days, and I could twist it with my thumb, and eventually it would hit a channel that we're watching. So I'm in the back of this dark auditorium, or dark room, you know, pretty small room, and we're watching TV, and I tuned in my jammer, and sure enough, it fuzzed up the picture on the screen. It didn't totally jam it, it just fuzzed it up. So I guess it didn't affect color TVs as well as black and whites. And one of my friends in the front row, with no planning or anything, goes and he hits the TV. And I made it go good. So everybody thought that it was, you know, a mechanical problem with this inanimate object. You know, and objects can be whacked. You don't whack a person, right? But you'll whack an object anytime it's failing. So after a while, I would jam it again, and he'd hit the TV, and it would go good. And then after a while, he had to hit the TV harder and harder to make it work. And eventually, he didn't go up to whack the TV, and somebody else went up and started whacking the TV. And I had my first, if you call it like a rat in a maze, to play psychological games with. So this game got to the point that people would reach up and tune the fine-tuning control, and pull, it gets good, and they pull their hand away, and it goes bad, and I was having so much fun. I got to where I could hold the jammer in my left hand, adjust the tuner on the TV with my right hand, and have it playing the same tricks on me that it would play on everyone else. And so another time I sent out a little bit of CQ ham radio stuff, and they heard it and said, oh, it must be the ham radio operator on the second floor. So we formed a little vigilante committee to go get the guy, and I was one of the members of that committee that they selected. So I never got caught. They had no idea that a human was playing with them. Well, one time they're up at the TV set, and a guy had his hand on the middle of the screen, and his foot was up in the air on a chair. And I made the picture go good. You know, and then they said, okay, it's good, everybody relax, and they pulled away, and the picture went bad, you know. And, you know, after a while, they said, get your body back where it was, because by now they somehow knew that where your body was mattered. It was a game I'd been playing for a few weeks, and this one guy eventually just put his hand back on the TV, and it worked. He took his hand off, and it didn't work, you know. So he put his hand on the TV, and he put his foot down on the floor, and it went bad. And he put his foot back up on the chair, and it went good. He turned to the audience, and he said, it's a grounding effect. So they watched the last half of Mission Impossible, half an hour, with a hand in the middle of a TV. I was so proud of that one. And then there was the time they said that the repairman was in. He said it's an antenna problem. So they lifted up the twin lead antenna, and the TV went good. Put it down, it's bad. So they're holding the antenna up. And after a while, the TV goes bad, so they hold it up a little higher to make it work. And then I got him to climb up on a chair. And I finally got it to the point that when the guy stood on his tiptoes, the TV was good, and when he came down on his heels, it wasn't. That was a lot of fun. I built one of those in a magic marker and took it to the first computer class of my life. And back in 1968, there weren't very many schools that had any undergraduate computer programs, so the only computer classes were grad programs at the University of Colorado. And I was, as a freshman and engineer, I was allowed to take it, even though it was a grad class. So I took my first computer class where they taught operating systems and compilers and Fortran and programming and registers in a computer and all this great stuff. It was a great class, and I got an A+ in it, but I wound up getting put on probation for computer abuse, or something that sounds just like that. And what I had done was, I said, what do computers do in life? You know, I really didn't know. Well, one of the things computers do is they calculate these big, huge number tables in the handbooks of chemistry and physics. So I wrote programs that would calculate powers of two and, you know, print 60 pages so it wouldn't time out, punch out some new cards so I could reinsert the deck a second time and get the next 60 pages and the next 60 pages. And the powers of two and the Fibonacci numbers and all this. I had 7 different programs growing the numbers to over a line long, 2 lines long, 3 lines, over a page long, over 2 pages long. The numbers were getting huge as my pages were getting up into the thousands, and I would run 7 programs times 60 pages times 3 runs a day, for piling up reams of output in my dorm room. And I didn't realize that you didn't get to program just because you were a student. The class had a budget. There was this whole money trail. And I had run the class 5 times over its budget. In front of me, the professor finally called the computer department and said, Mr. Wozniak should pay this. And it was a lot more than tuition. So I was so scared I didn't want to go back to that school. But at least in that computer class, I did build a little TV jammer inside of a magic marker. And when I took it to class and put it in the binders of my notebook, and the sets were fuzzed up only a little because it was closed-circuit TV, and the one set near me wasn't even fuzzed up at all. The one across on the right was the worst. You know, there were different levels for the 4 TV sets because a lot of us didn't see the class live. A lot of us had to watch it on these 4 TVs. Only a few special people got to see it live, the upper grad students. So 3 TAs in the front of the class stand up. I didn't know we had any teachers in this class. I was just going to turn on the jammer and turn it off so people would know that somebody had played with them a little. And these 3 guys stood up, and they're watching us like hawks. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm not going to reach down and turn it off. You know, they made an announcement. Whoever's got the transmitter, turn it off. Well, I'm not going to reach down and turn it off and get caught. The guy next to me will see me do it. So it's in a magic market. I sat there all scared. And finally, after about 20 minutes, half an hour, I thought, well, I will just walk out with everyone else, and they won't know who had it. Well, near the end of class, this guy who's under the TV that's jammed the worst starts collecting his books so he can leave early. And so as he's walking towards the door, I couldn't resist. I made the sets go in and out, in and out. And then when he walked out the door, the TVs were perfect. And I saw a TA point like this. And later, I talked to a friend who was right behind the TA. The TA said, there he goes. So learned a lesson. Always make it look like someone else did it. Going ahead a few years later, you know, after Blue Boxes and stuff like that. Well, I was in a bowling alley with my fiance, and I saw this little game sitting there, Pong. And it was just so mesmerizing. It cost a quarter when all the pinball games cost a dime. But it was worth it, and two players had to play. And this little dinky sound and a paddle, somebody had taken a TV set and put pictures on it so it would play a game. It was the most incredible thing. And as I sat there and stared at it, I said to my fiancé, well, I know how television signals work from high school electronics. And I know digital design because I've been trying to design computers. You know, never get the parts. I'm going to build one of those. I could build one of those. And by then, I worked at Hewlett-Packard, sort of like my first job, designing calculators. So I had access to parts. And I built myself a Pong game. And I was known for building things with very few parts, so it was very tiny and tight. And I put in two extra chips called PROMs that stored a little 256-byte program. Well, if you had two of them, it stored a 256-byte program. I think I used one of these PROMs, 4 bits by 256, so that if you missed the ball, it put a four-letter word in the corners if you had a switch on. Well, four different four-letter words, like darn. So I was real proud of my little Pong game, you know, and it was kind of like this was the start of video games as far as I knew. It was, you know, I'd never seen anything before this Pong arcade game, and it was like the science fiction dreams and the stories you read, you know, that there's some kind of alternate universe, and now we can control this little alternate universe of game here, but it's sort of not real in a sense. And boy, I was going to be hooked on that sort of thing forever. At home, to build this device, of course, I couldn't afford any sort of output device, but everybody has a TV set, right? And the TV sets back in those days came with schematics. So I opened up the back of my Sears TV and probed around with an oscilloscope, and I found, or a meter, and I found where the video signal was, so I just inserted my own video signal there, and that's how I got the Pong to play on my TV set for free, which was one of the big hassles. Now, the TV sets meant it was NTSC signals, so I had to, you know, to build this Pong game, I kind of had to start designing just a bunch of horizontal and vertical counters and choose the right kinds of chips for that, you know, and figure out timing-wise how to put out the dots that would eventually become a game. So it was just a normal good experience to learn how to make a game for NTSC. When you built a game out of hardware like that, there was no quick fix or anything. I mean, if you put a wire in and connected it to a certain pin, maybe you could figure out a way to move the wire to another pin or put in a little gate, an extra chip or something, and you could move the score up a little on the screen. My approach was to take whatever fell out of the chips the easiest. I had learned this with a bunch of mini computers in the 70s came out. Around 1970, about 20 different companies came out with mini computers, and each one of them had like 50 different instructions, and then the Data General Nova came out. The Data General Nova had one instruction, broke it into little bits. 2 bits meant which source register, 2 more bits meant which other source register, 3 bits meant do you add, subtract, multiply, divide, or, and, exclusive, or, blah, blah, blah. And another bit for carry setting and shifting after the fact. There's 16 bits, and I thought, that is so weird. You can't do, you know, add one to a register, but you can do a bunch of other things. I wonder how this instruction works. So finally, when I designed my version, I would design all these mini computers on paper just to see how I could do and get better and better, try to beat my own designs. My rule was the fewer chips, the better. And when I designed this Data General Nova, the whole instruction register, the 2 bits that specified a source were 2 wires over to a little multiplexer. The 2 for the other was 2 wires to another multiplexer. The 3 wires to say what you do went to the 3 inputs of a chip that could do all those things. And another one for the carry went to the input of an adder and blah, blah, blah. And it just fell out. And it was half as many chips as all the other mini computer designs I'd ever done. So what I learned from that is if you do a design, try to do your design around chips the way they exist. Don't just define your game or your whatever, or your computer, in advance and build it. You'll use twice as many chips as you need to. You can build an equivalent one by working that way. So with this Pong game, it was pretty much, you know, oh, God, if I wanted to try some variations of it and ball speed and all that, it took forever to redesign it, put some chips in, resolder a ton of wires. And if you didn't like it, you have to move all the wires back. It just took forever because games were hardware. Games were not software yet. Somewhere around this time, my good friend Steve Jobs actually got a job working for Atari, which was, you know, when the big thing going on in the world is video games. and arcade games, and they're just changing the world for those of us who are interested in this sort of thing. He got a job there. I guess he was very persuasive. He could walk in and just talk his way into a job, and he wasn't quite an engineer, but he understood electronics, and he could have become a design engineer, but he could, like, fix up their games that they designed in Grass Valley and do that sort of stuff. And he had a really free type of life, if you will, and he would work at Atari for a few months, and then he'd go work up with friends on an orchard in Oregon that he didn't tell me much about, so who knows what was there. And then he'd come back to Atari, and but that was kind of cool because I got to go in and, you know, see some of the new games that were being built once in a while. He'd bring me in. And I remember one time the guys at Atari kind of liked this little Pong game I had done because it only had 28 chips. And they said, "You want a job?" And I said, "No, I work for Hewlett-Packard. It's a company that believes in engineers. You can be an engineer for life. It doesn't force you to have to move up the ladder and try to become something other than a designer, an engineer, and that's where I'm going to stay for life. So nobody could hire me away from Hewlett-Packard." Somewhere around this time, I went to a friend's house. His name was John Draper, Captain Crunch. And he's an interesting character, of course. So he was down in the basement in Cupertino, and he's plugging away on a teletype, typing on a teletype, a sort of equipment I could never afford to get near, but he was in somebody else's house. And he says, "I'm playing chess with a computer in Boston." And then he flips over to a computer at Stanford and Santa Barbara, and basically he's on this thing called the ARPANET. And it's all these computers. You dial a number over in Palo Alto, and you can bounce around computer to computer to computer. Text lines on the teletype let you make choices as to what computer you were on and what was available for guests and all this stuff. And it was just an amazing world. It's like getting beyond your own boundaries. I had done this with ham radio. You could get out and get long distance. With blue boxes, you could make calls all over the world. And now here was a new way, a network that got to computers across the country. So I had to do this. Had to do this. Well, the only way I can do it with no money is I've got to build something of my own. So I said, I could build a terminal. The only output device I could ever have. I couldn't afford some printing typewriter. I couldn't afford printers in those days. I couldn't afford a teletype. Good God, this is 1973 maybe, and it's even before PCs came around or even hobby computers like the Altair. So I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, what do I do? Well, I've got my TV set at home, the same one I use for Pong. It's free, so I have free output. All I have to do is put the dots in the shape of a character. I'll buy a character generator chip. Who's to know that RCA had a patent and was going to want $5 for every Apple II someday? just on putting characters on a raster scan screen, kind of weird what you can do when you can afford to do things. So I had a home TV for output, but what am I going to use for input for a terminal? You got to type. You got to type English. And you got to type English like on a QWERTY keyboard. So I searched all the electronic magazines at Hewlett-Packard that came out, and they had one deal that offered a keyboard for $60, which was great. And that's probably, what, 500 of today's dollars. It's expensive. But most of the keyboards were much more expensive than that. This was expensive back then. So I bought this $60 keyboard, even though it didn't have lowercase, which was going to be a big impact on Apple someday. But I wanted this terminal where I could get onto computers. And by the way, they had some games on these computers, and that was one of the big attractions. This is sort of back in the days of Star Trek and Wumpus games. So I built the terminal of my own design, you know, the horizontal scanners, the vertical scanners for my TV set, something to put the characters out the right way and turn on and off the bits on the TV set, and got this little home terminal done just so I could call up the ARPANET. I did it a couple times, but mainly it was to show people. Now, Steve Jobs comes along, and he sees this terminal that's working in my house, a little board, you know, with a couple wires to a transformer and a keyboard and something else, and he says, "Oh, we should sell it. We could sell it to Call Computer." So somehow we actually worked a deal and sold some. Because whatever I designed, he always came along and said, "We should sell it." That was true of the blue boxes, too. It was a very easy, simple, logical step for me to move from a Pong game into something that was a terminal that let me play games on faraway computers. And so then there was... I had some classes. I was still 1 year away from a college degree, so I was taking a few engineering courses at San Jose State while I worked at Hewlett-Packard in Cupertino. And at San Jose State, in the student lounge, they had this game called, I think it was Computer Space, one that reputedly had come out even before Pong, an arcade game. And I would sit there every day after classes, and I got so good at that thing, I could make a few quarters last a long time. I remember one time, I'm playing Computer Space. I could almost always get into the second round of the game. Playing Computer Space, and some Mexican guy comes and covers up my eyes, and real quickly, and he says, "Don't screw up," and he uncovers my eyes. And I thought, what an idiot. I'm in the middle of a game. One miss, you know, you can just blow a game for you. What an idiot that guy was. When I finally finished the game, about 5 minutes later, I looked down. All my quarters were gone. He swiped them. I thought that was pretty clever, actually. So, anyway, Steve Jobs came to me at one point and he said, well, you know, Nolan Bushnell is interested in doing a game, and it's kind of like a one-player pong game, and it was going to eventually become Breakout. And Steve described it to me, and he said, do you think you could do it? And I said, yeah, I could do that. And he says, well, how many chips do you think you could do it in? I said, well, I'll have to think about it. And I worked out for a few minutes, and probably about 45 chips. So Steve says, okay, well, here's the deal. No one's tired of these games that take tons and tons of chips, 90 chips, 100, 120, 140 chips, you know, up close to 200 chips. Tired of it. And he knows you design things with few chips. So could you do the, if you could do the breakout under 50 chips, we'll get $700. And if you can do it under 40 chips, we get $1,000. Wow, that was intriguing. I said, oh, man, yeah, sure. But actually, just, you know, heck, I worked at Hewlett Packard as an engineer just to do these things on the side. I had lots of side projects that were, you know, early hotel movie systems, the earliest VCRs, all that kind of stuff. So I had a great, exciting world, but just to design an arcade game would be the coolest thing in the world. And I said, sure. And then Steve says, well, there's a hitch. Has to be done in 4 days. Now, this is before games were programs. They weren't even programs. And you had to hook a wire up, and if you made a mistake, move the wire, try something different, put in a couple chips and re-solder wires and all this. It was in those days of it took a long, long time. Normally, a game done hardware might take, you know, many months, 6 months might be typical. And he wants it in 4 days. And I just sort of said, well, I'll try. So we spent 4 days and nights, both of us, up all day and all night. At least I was up all day designing, all night. I was in Atari. Steve would actually do the wire wrapping of the game. And while he was wire wrapping for quite a while, I would go out on the factory floor. And they had this new game, the first driving game about to come out, Grand Track 10. Man, I played so much Grand Track 10 night, you know, for hours and hours and hours through those nights, you know, when I should have been sleeping. So much of it, I got so good at it that in later year they had a Grand Track 10 machine in a pizza parlor in Scotts Valley where I lived. And I walked in and it said, if you get over 36 points, you get a free pizza. Well, heck, I knew I could get 40 points. So after I won my second free pizza, they took the game out. But that was a little fallout of this breakout design. And anyway, 4 days and nights, Steve and I both got mononucleosis, being up so hard. I mean, we shared one Coke, so that must have been it. And we got the game delivered. It was 40-some chips, so we only got $700 for it, and that was a bummer. Oh, well. Anyway, that breakout game, it was neat. I would have done it for free. It was just neat to say you did a game. Heck, I took a week vacation off Hewlett Packard just because, I drove Steve down to De Anza College, and they had a posted board for jobs, and he got a job. He could get a job dressing up as the Mad Hatter and the White Rabbit at Westgate Mall. And I thought, that is so neat. You get to be one of those little characters like Disneyland. Man, I want to do that. So I took a week's vacation from my engineering salary so I could go get minimum wage dressing up like a little character for kids. And it was one of the greatest things I ever did in my life. You know, and that's the difference between me and Steve Little, because I look back at that as so fun. He thinks it was just a worthless job that didn't pay, but it was just neat to have done. And, well, the Homebrew Computer Club started up, and I'd really drifted away from microprocessors. I didn't know anything about them. While I was down at Atari doing the breakout game, I saw a couple glimpses of the first machine they were going to have with a microprocessor. I don't know if the microprocessor was going to program the game or just monitor the buttons that people press. I didn't know. It was some big 16-player or 8-player driving game or some sort. And I also saw little examples of color on games where they put cellophane plastic over things to kind of make it look colored. And in my head, while I was sitting there in this kind of dreamy state on about the third night that you're up all night long, and I'm kind of sitting there at the lab bench at Atari, and this little idea popped in my head. I know kind of from my background in electronics how complicated color television signal definitions and all the phases and the mixing of the X, Y, and B, Y, and R, Y, and whatever Ys there are. I sort of knew about that, and it wasn't my field of electronics. I was sort of more digital than analog. And this idea just popped in my head that what if I had a shift register and I spun it around at television rate and then took the 4 bits that were coming out of it, and then they could make a square wave that was sort of like 3.58 megahertz, which is like what color is on a TV set. And what if I shifted those 4 bits over a little bit in the shift register when I started it spinning? Then I would shift the phase from blue to green to red to yellow. And it sort of made sense. And I wonder if all these 16 codes would wind up looking like brighter and dimmer signals and with more ones and more zeros. And I had no idea. Just a big, huge, risky idea popped in my head. I wonder if you just did that, could you get color out for almost no chips and no parts, not even knowing what you're doing? Would it show up on a color TV as color? So I filed that little formula in my head for a later year. When the Homebrew Computer Club started up, I discovered microprocessors had come that basically they were like mini computers that I had been designing back in high school. And I said, oh my gosh. I mean, at the end of high school, I told my dad, I'm going to have a computer someday. He said, it's going to cost as much as a house. I said, I'll live in an apartment. I was going to have one. And going to that club meeting, I finally discovered there are parts out you can buy for $400 that are a processor. And there are computers you could buy for $400. Somebody talked about an Altair and showed a picture. And you can buy these other chips. And I know how to hook any chips together and make things, so I'll design my own computer. And I couldn't afford a $400 microprocessor. But at Hewlett-Packard, I found out I could buy a Motorola 6800 for $40. Okay, so I'm in business. So I went to the drafting board late at night at my cubicle at HP and drafted out the picture of basically a 6800 microprocessor connected to some RAM. Everybody was using static RAM in those days because you connect the address pins to the address pins, the data pins to the data pins, and it's real easy to hook up, you know, from the data sheets. So that was easy. And then I just connected it through one little chip that connected 8 bits down to my terminal that had input and output already. I had a keyboard that went into this microprocessor now, and I had video that went out to the terminal, out to a TV set from it. And why all the other computers in that day were pretty much a big motherboard and a bunch of slots that you'd plug cards in. And one of those cards might be RAM, a little bit of RAM, a little bit more RAM, a little bit more RAM. And there was a company called Krememco that came out with two big boards full of, each one had as many chips as an Apple II. And they would have color, and there was another board that would connect over to a teletype. So you'd pay a lot of money and have all this junk, and the front panel looked like an airplane cockpit with switches and lights and, you know, stuff you couldn't understand. Well, I'd actually built one of my own design computers 5 years before that, 1970. I had a little 256-byte machine, some switches I could toggle and some lights, and I could byte by byte by byte. I could push a program into memory, byte by byte by byte, and run it. And yes, it would multiply two of the switches times two of the others and put the display in the lights, and it was kind of worthless, but it was a computer. Well, here was now a chance that people could really buy that sort of thing. But now I was working at Hewlett-Packard, and we had calculators, and calculators were so human, and they were for human beings. You know, you press 5 plus 3, and everybody understands what it means. Well, on a computer, just like my terminal to talk to the ARPANET, you want to talk in English. You know, you don't really want to flip these awful switches. And our calculators, the way they worked is they had a little program in ROM. It was only about the equivalent of maybe 500 bytes total, maybe less. And it would sit there looking for you to press a key, and when you press the 5 button, it would run a program and put 5 in the display, and now go look at, are you pressing a key? So I said, I'll write a program for this little microprocessor that just says, is a key being pressed on the keyboard? And when a key gets pressed, I'll go and stuff it in a bit of memory and do whatever I have to do with the key. And I wrote this little 256-byte program that did everything the airplane cockpit switches would do. Let you toggle in an address. You could type an address now in hexadecimal. You could type in some data and say store it. You could basically say store it and store this data in this address with my little 256-byte program. You could examine a bunch of data that's in memory in hexadecimal. And you could go, say, run a program at a certain address in hexadecimal. So the whole front panel went away, and it saved a ton of switches, a ton of wires from those switches, a ton of chips they had to go in to understand what they were doing, and a ton of multiplexing in the memory. It all went away into one little tiny 256-byte microprocessor program. And, of course, a keyboard, but that was a lot easier hookup, took a lot fewer chips. Now, it took me 2 PROM chips in those days. They didn't have a 256-byte PROM. 2 PROM chips to have 256 bytes, and I had to go across the street to program it. So anyway, that kind of worked. It was to become the heart of the Apple I. The processor I actually went with got introduced, the latest, greatest, with a lot of addressing modes, which I liked, and that was a 6502. And boy, was that a nice processor. So lucky to have gotten a good start with that. And it was compatible with the design I'd done for the 6800. So when I finally built it up one night, I got it working finally at Hewlett-Packard about one night to where I could, you know, I soldered everything, you do all the jobs when you're in those early days. You do it all. You design it on paper, you draft it on a drafting board, you decide where the chips are going to go on a board, you plug them in, you label things, you solder all the wires from pin to pin to pin and mark them off on your schematics, you put the chips in, you test it, you put an oscilloscope on and find out how the address bits look and fix the problems and, you know, and rewrite the code a little and you test it. So you do everything as one person. which makes it real motivating. And I was real lucky because I was all alone. I'd just go to my cubicle at Hewlett Packard late at night. I'd go home maybe at 5 or 6, normal time, do a little stuff at home, take some live jokes on my dial-a-joke line. And that I'm really proud of that because, you know, you'll meet a lot of people start companies, but you'll only meet one in your life probably that started the first dial-a-joke ever in a regional area. That was me. The first dial-a-joke in the Bay Area. That was back. Thank you. Back before people ask, what are you most proud of? That's the one I say, not Apple. But you couldn't buy an answering machine back then. You couldn't buy a telephone back then. It was back in those Monopoly days, and so it was very expensive and very hard to do. And boy, that's another set of good fun stories. So anyway, got this computer together, and Job says, you know what? And I start showing it at the Homebrew Computer Club. And, you know, right nowadays we got all this intellectual property and you protect everything and nobody can know what it is and they can't even see it in operation. I would take it down, hook up the Sears TV and put it out on display, partly because I was so shy then I couldn't talk to people. But if they came up and asked me questions about something I had done, I could talk. So my best means of communication was not with opening up words, but by describing things I had done in life. So that's why I like to build neat, attractive, cute things. I passed out schematics to everybody at the Homebrew Computer Club. Full schematics of the Apple I. Code listings. Build your own. So that's how Apple got started, if anyone's interested. You know, not with a lot of IP protection. So anyway, Steve comes along. He says, tell you, look, all these people, they can get chips from their companies, but the trouble is it takes a long time to solder them together. And there's a whole bunch of people that, you know, want to build their own computer in this computer club. Why don't we build PC boards for $20, sell them for $40? You know, we did some calculations. We'd have to, you know, raise a few hundred bucks each. I had to sell my most valuable possession, my HP 65 calculator, for $500. But then again, I knew that next month we were coming out with HP 67 and my employee price would be $370. And Steve sold the van. We got a few hundred bucks together to pay a friend to lay out a PC board for this Apple I project. Well, the first thing I said actually was, well, no, if I design something, it's going to be sold. My design goes to Hewlett-Packard first. So I approached Hewlett-Packard and got my first turndown. I was to get three turndowns from them eventually. And so we're going to make this PC board. And when it got done, I brought it and showed it to the engineers at Hewlett-Packard. I was just so proud of it, you know, and it was a little computer. And by then, the goal of this computer was to give me my own computer on my desk. We had one computer in the lab that serviced 40 engineers. I'd have my own. And I could run my simulations for Hewlett-Packard on it was one of the two goals, and the other was to run games. In the Homebrew Computer Club, it was easy to hear people talking about you know, a lot of the revolutions computers were going to cause and a lot of the serious things they'd be used for and how they would be in every home and they'd run our homes, the environment, and all this stuff. But everybody talked about games. A lot came back to games, and there was a book called 101 Basic Games. I'd never programmed in BASIC in my life, but I could sniff the winds, and I could tell that BASIC was the starting place for these small computers because to have games gave somebody something instantly they could do with a computer. I was also lucky that I really didn't know what computers were used for in life. I didn't know who in companies ran financial reports, what kind of software they had, what is COBOL. All I knew was a little bit of engineering programming I'd done in college. And so I knew that if I could build a computer that can do the sort of programs I need for work and the games, then I've got at least a part of a computer. At least I've got enough of a computer to satisfy me. I don't know if it's enough of a computer for where computers are really used, but that didn't matter to me, and I didn't care. So anyways, we're getting closer to this. So I got this thing, and it's actually working, and we're not really, we're still hexadecimal. I would sit in the back of the Homebrew Computer Club, the very last row, plug in the wall there, and I would type 4K of the BASIC I was working on. Took me 40 minutes. Now, to learn BASIC, since I'd never programmed in it, I opened up a Hewlett-Packard BASIC manual at work. I wrote down my syntax diagrams. I'd never taken a course in writing compilers and interpreters, but I figured out some good structured methods to do it. And some of the best things I did, all the best things I did, actually, for Apple were largely because I didn't have the money and to do it, to just buy it or do it in an expensive way, and I didn't have the knowledge of how it had been done before. I had to come up with a way, and it was usually pretty good. So I wrote a BASIC, and I called it Game BASIC as I wrote it in all my documentation. I couldn't afford an assembler at that time. So what I did was I wrote the mnemonics of the microprocessor on the left side of the page for all the code that's in the Apple II, and then I converted with my tables to the hexadecimal on the right-hand side, and then I typed the hexadecimal in. with my little front panel simulator, and that was how I did all the development of the all the way up to delivering the shipping the first Apple II. It's all handwritten, nothing out of a computer. You know, which is how a lot of good things come. Well, you know, and Bill Gates had written his BASIC, and now I wanted, well, one of the reasons that I wanted to write this BASIC, this game BASIC, was I wanted to be the first person to have one for the 6502, because you get known for things if you're first, and then I can talk to people. And man, I worked so hard. I did more work on that BASIC than I did on any of the hardware designs in Apple. It was the hardest project I ever did. What was my goal? To have this BASIC in the end play games that were text-based for the Apple I, because the Apple II wasn't quite here yet. The text-based games, Wumpus and Star Trek and those kind, I could buy 101 computer games and type them in. Well, I didn't realize that there was Digital Equipment BASIC and there was Hewlett-Packard BASIC. And Digital Equipment did strings a different way. And that was the way that Bill Gates had done. I only had new Hewlett-Packard BASIC because I'd never programmed in BASIC in my life, and they had a better way to do strings, in my opinion, and that's how I did it. So all these books of computer games had to be converted to my string style, so it was still sort of a hassle there. Now, I'd been thinking about color when I designed the Apple I, so I designed it with the right clock frequency that I could add color in a later way with this little device idea of spinning a shift register, and the ones and zeros that come out might look like color on a TV set. Well, as I started working towards adding color to the Apple I, it was just condensed, a ton of great design work, and I finally, you know, saved about half the chips and made the video memory out of the processor. And by this point in time, after I built my first Apple I, I said, you know what, I count chips, and if 4K of RAM is 32 RAM chips of these 1K static RAMs, the 4K Dynamics came out that year, 1975, from three companies. If I use the dynamic RAMs, it's only 8 chips, but I have to keep refreshing it. Well, big deal. Refreshing cost me another 4 chips or something. It didn't cost that much. It's a net savings on chips that was huge. So at least I had dynamic RAMs, while all these other little hobby computers, as they called themselves, that had the big airplane cockpit front panels and were, you know, kind of offensive in ways, they all used static RAMs, so they were hugely more expensive, and they had many more chips and more power and all these other problems, and I had this nice little tight design. Well, as I started working on it, I condensed things, and figured out that I can use a little state machine to save a few chips in the timing generator, and then search every book until I found one shift register with the right combinations of inputs and outputs and synchronous, that it would put out all the different signals to my dynamic RAMs in one chip. I just do everything in the world to just get the chip count down to nothing. And at some point, I knew that in the future, I want this machine, it's going to have color. I tested the color, and it worked on a TV set. It was one of those eureka moments, you know, where you take a risk, something might not even work, and doggone it, with, you know, I had the color sync signals and everything in there, and it came out as color on my TV set, and it came out on virtually every TV set, probably. And I was just sort of shocked and called Steve Jobs over, and it was one of my trembling moments with him, you know, that this was so incredible, because it took almost no chips to do the color, one little shift register spinning around. So that was a big plus for it. And then I thought, you know what? Games, like Breakout. I got this goal. I said, when I was at Atari, they were talking about microprocessors. You could program a microprocessor, a million operations a second, assembly language, and it might be able to play a game. And I said, now I have a machine, a basis, that could play the game. I put in graphics, so color squares, color blocks could appear in place of characters. And then, instead of the graphics, I even put in a little high-res with little individual dots could have a little bit of color shading to them. And I didn't think that was worth the two chips it cost, you know. Like, I don't think anybody's going to use these high-res things in the future, you know. But Steve Jobs, you know, I actually wouldn't have taken two chips out for that. But I said to Steve, we could save two more chips if we leave it out. And he said, no, leave it in. It's only two chips. So, we did leave it in. Along with slots and other things. So now I had this game with the high-res graphics, and an idea popped into my head one day. I had written the BASIC. I wonder if you could write a game like Breakout in BASIC instead of assembly language. Okay, and this was pretty uncertain because BASIC's kind of slow and interpreted. Well, one day I added the command to draw a color square, and then I added a command to draw a color horizontal line and a vertical line and to change the colors. I added them to my BASIC because I had written it. And then I put in, you know, and I already had the color hardware, and then I had needed paddles. So I took a little four-timer circuit, and the microprocessor could put a signal into it and time how long a pot that you turn decayed and then know where the pot was. So you could have a paddle control. So I had four paddle controls all done in one chip, and then put one little bit out through a transistor to a speaker, one bit of sound. It was amazing what people were going to do with that one bit in later years, but... So I had enough to do a game, and I sat down on my floor in my apartment in Cupertino one day, and here's a little board on the floor, and cables snaking into the back of my Sears TV, and I started writing some basic commands for I equals 1 to whatever to draw some bricks. And I made it a different size of bricks. Okay, and I got it straightened out. Then I'll say I'll make you know, 8 rows of bricks with those colors alternating. And it was real easy. A couple little basic statements, and it just takes, you know, half a minute. And now I had the bricks kind of okay, and I didn't like the color. So I started playing with change this color to green and that one to red, change this to that, try yellow. Started changing all the colors around, and I went through about 30 variations in 3 minutes. In hardware, that would have taken me, let's say, a year of continual changing wires around, the amount of changes I played with. Programmed in a little paddle and made it so it would move up and down the screen, then programmed a ball and started playing with the speeds of the ball and the dimensions and all this. Half an hour, I had beautiful, beautiful breakout game done with all the aspects of breakout. I had chosen where the scores would be, what color they would be, what words might pop up when you did something good. And so I called Steve over to the house. I mean, I just called Steve over. I was shocked that I had done in half an hour what would have probably taken me 500 years in hardware to play with that many variations of a game. And I sat down on the floor, and I was just shaking. And I just said, Steve, this is done. It's basic. Now that games are software, games will never be the same. And it was like one of those eureka moments where, you know, that was my realization that, oh, my gosh, you can make a game a program and do a lot more. On the way to this Apple II, we knew we'd have like real big sales, but we needed to raise about $250,000 because Steve and I still had no money. We didn't have a car. We didn't have a bank account with, you know, from Apple I's. Maybe we had $10,000, and that was it. So we needed a lot of money. How do you build 1,000 computers when they cost $250 each? We went to a couple of companies looking for money. We went to Commodore. And they said, no, we're going to do a real cheap schlock computer and save money, and you really have done too much, and we'll do it in 4 months. And that's what they did. And their vice president of engineering actually left Commodore and came to Apple saying we had the right product. And we went to Atari, and our friends at Atari were about to come out, went over to Al Alcorn's house and displayed the computer and what it could do and some fancy color spirals on his TV set. And they were interested in it, but they were about to come out with their first home Pong game. And that was a real big deal at the time, so they had their hands full and didn't have time to do a computer. So and we finally ran into some VCs that said, what's the market? And I said, 1 million. How do you know it's 1 million? I said, well, there's 1 million ham radio operators, and computers is bigger than ham radio. And that wasn't the right marketing talk. So it wasn't the right sort of words. So eventually we got on to Mike Markla, and he agreed to basically put in the money and fund us. But the early ideas that he and Steve Jobs had really weren't games. It was more use it at your home for recipes and kind of like some serious home stuff. Education popped in there. And, keeping your recipes and doing your checkbook. Those were the big ones. And if you look back at our ads, that'll show up. But really, the rest of the world was going to discover that this was a real easy open game machine. Mike Scott was our president that we hired. Mike Scott and myself had this big campaign to get out every bit of documentation we had, how to use it, examples of boards that had been designed, which was real easy, examples of every level of the software, so that anybody out there could start playing with it and learn it and write their own very easily by modifying it. And that's how I had learned programming. I hadn't really learned it in classes in school. I'd stumbled across other people's programs once in a while in a manual and learned it that way. And thank God that Mike Scott saw that, because I think some of the other people in Apple might not have liked it if they sort of saw that we were really being that open. And it worked out, and a lot of people were able to very early start writing games for the Apple II. But they went much further. We didn't know how far people were going to go. We didn't know there was going to be any games even written using our high-res graphics. When we introduced the Apple II at the computer show was that we introduced it at in San Francisco. The first West Coast Computer Fair, yes. Well, everything you do, and my philosophy had always been, everything you do in work should be fun. And it should have a fun aspect, and you should have jokes around it. You should joke with your workers, and you should have jokes in the machine, and, you know, things like Easter eggs and all that. So when we introduced the Apple II, I set it up for demo. Somebody could walk up to it, and I had a joke program. You would type, it would ask you your name, and then it would try to figure out what your nationality was. And this was back before political correctness, so it would tell all the jokes with that nationality. And it was all the same jokes. So if your name ended with a vowel, are you Italian, it would ask. And if you typed yes, then it would tell the jokes as Italian jokes. And I had nine pages of those jokes would come for you. And also I put out a brochure that I had made with a friend in Los Angeles, I was afraid of getting caught, for a phony computer called the Zaltair. And you could send your Altair in, get money back, and you'd have this Zaltair. But I was careful to remember, always make it look like someone else did it. So I had a dumb little quote in italics at the top of this two-page brochure that had, you know, how to send your own computer back and comparison charts with other computers like the Apple. Had a dumb little quote saying, predictable refinement of computer or something or other. But if you took the first letter of each word, spelled out processor technology. And it was funny because eventually somebody who hadn't even read that said it must have been this guy Gary somebody from Processor Technology because he had a strange sense of humor. Gordon French said that. I guess he didn't know me. So, you know, people would send things in the mail right away. And Bob Bishop, this guy at JPL, wrote this little thing called Lunar Lander where you'd try to land a little spaceship softly and softly on the moon. I mean, those kind of programs and these little tiny things that meant so much back then and were taking the world, you know, in the very first steps towards computer games was so important. Boy, when I ran into Bob, boy, I sat down with him and talked him into joining Apple. And he did things like Apple Vision, little guys dancing on TV sets, and other people did things that sounded like, you know, chords and tons of notes of music playing at once coming out of a little one-bit speaker. Had another interesting friend show up again, John Draper. And it was kind of funny because back when I had my Apple, my terminal, back before I built a computer, I had the terminal, John Draper was on the floor calling his call computer. And he put one hand over the keys right above the left-hand home row, and he goes, click, 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 click. So it's four letters, and it's all in the W-E-R area. So the second password, I guess, was Steve Jobs, was W-E-R-E, and I was into his account. Okay, it's one of only three passwords I ever kind of figured out that way my whole life. So, because I'm not really a computer hacker. Well, so I went onto his account, and we saw that he had this big, long resume in there, and Steve and I were going to add his rest down at the bottom of it. But we didn't. But we didn't. So anyway, he came, we had this early Apple, and we're kind of in one building, maybe about half the size of this, and we're all spread out, manufacturing benches and everything in there. And then we opened up, I wanted to hire John Draper to do a phone board, because I figured computers should attach to anything electronic. They attach to phone lines, they attach to this. But you know what? I had done dial-a-joke with an answering machine. The computer should be able to sit on a phone line, dial calls, like touch tone. It should be able to listen to the tones that come back and tell if it's busy or ringing or whatever, you know, and modems weren't going to do this for another 12 years. But, it, you know, so they could turn on answering machines. They should have a bunch of outputs that'll go to switches that'll start and stop the tape recorder to be your answering machine and connect the audio of the tape recorder in and out of the phone line. So it was a real general phone control board. It wasn't a modem. And I hired John Draper to do that. And everybody at Apple hated him right away because he just was obnoxious and he did not like their cigarettes and he was rude about it. And so everybody would, just to get rid of him, they'd just light up a cigarette. So we opened up a second little tiny office, and there were three of us in it, myself, Randy Williamson, and John Draper, and he worked on this board, and I worked with him, and he got a phase lock loop to detect tones and used the same phase lock loop to generate the touch tones, and this board turned out great. And his motivation on this board to get it done, you know, as well as he did, and it was really good design, his motivation was there were things called Watts extender numbers where you could call into some companies on an 800 line, type 76 number sign or something, it goes beep, 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 beep. And then, you know, and this board could listen to that beep, 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 beep. And then you punch in a four-digit code, and you get an outgoing 800 number. It's for executives to call in for free and call out for free anywhere in the country back before we had national plans and all this stuff. So his idea was to crack those four-digit codes. And he finally got this board programmed up, and it would go through these numbers, try and code, you know, it would dial the call, wait till it got answered. The instant it got answered, it didn't have to wait for 10 seconds and hope it got answered. The instant it got answered, it would detect it and type in 76 number sign, and then it would try 0000. And it would either hear that it didn't go through or it went through. It could tell by the tones right away. Hang up, it would try the next one. It was dialing 5,000 calls a night. Finally, they cut off his phone line one day in Mountain View. And they called him in and told him that they have a percentage of the number of calls dialed that don't go through. Normally it's 30%, and that month it had jumped to 80% because of his calls. So I figure he might have made half the calls in Mountain View that month. And his machine was, yeah, cracking these Watts extenders about one a night. And I was walking over to lunch with my friend Randy Wigginton one day, and I got this great idea. Why don't I change his 800 number to an 808 Hawaiian number? And we started laughing. He'd have 20,000 phone bills at the end of the month, 20,000 phone calls, and it would be about 6 inches thick of phone bill, and it would be $22,000. That's what we figured, $22,000. And that was too high an estimate. I couldn't play with that kind of money, so I never did it. But So, well, might as well, you know, like I said, work should be a little bit fun. We at one point, as we started selling Apple IIs, and really the games on the Apple II were kicking it off more than anything else, and they were on cassette tape in those days. We didn't have the floppy disk yet. Dana Reddington was a guy that we hired, and he was kind of like a philosophy grad student. I think he had a graduate degree, and he was working with all these medical doctors on analyzing alpha waves and wanted to do that with the Apple II. I think he did hook something up. But he programmed a video game for us. We thought, why don't we try to make a game that's like the arcade games with ships going through the sky, and you aim a little rocket, and you try to shoot them. And we called the game Star Wars. I mean, you know, sure, we got shut down, too, by Lucas eventually. I mean, we had to change the name. But we actually called it Star Wars, and it was a really great game. And the number of tricks you had to play on a microprocessor level to get a little bit more processing coming out of it than you really had the microseconds for, those were just the greatest times. And, you know, the Apple II, of course, went through a lot of the early game development phases, working their way up to better sounds and things like pinball games and making movement look smoother and smoother and having more colors on the screen. And, you know, it was kind of like it was more work, more value added in the industry as it developed. Guys were working on music boards even inside of Apple. They would do it on their spare time. Like Charlie Kellner developed all these boards that became the Alpha Centauri music system. And eventually, Trip Hawkins, you know, was at Apple, and he really wanted to do entertainment products and games. And Jobs just couldn't really justify it and find a way in Apple. We were too serious a company. By now, we had VisiCalc and a floppy disk, and businesses were the big market. So Trip basically left to do what he really wanted to do, and that was Electronic Arts. And we know where that one got. Well, a lot of companies, you know, once they get big money, they kind of, like, look frown on game type stuff. Well, that's how it is. Myself, when the Game Boy came out, one of the things I'm proud about, I played a number of arcade games. I played Defender so well I could roll the score over a lot. I had a bunch of video arcade games in my house. And I like to collect like the ones that I thought were the classics, like Crystal Castle, the first one with a good trackball. Dragon's Lair, the first one with a laser disc player, and a lot of these ones that kind of were like new genres, and you know, where you play a real pinball game, it would zip up to a little Pac-Man baby or whatever. And so I love kind of these new little steps and keep them. But I'm sort of the guy that just likes to play simple games, the early games, and play them a lot instead of being like the kids who can go around and play game after game after game after game after game. And I could never touch a kid in my life. I mean, I couldn't even match a kid with computers after about fourth grade if they have education. So I would play, Defender was one of the few I played. But when Game Boy came out with Tetris, I started playing it with some friends, and I got really good at Tetris. And I am so proud because, you know, most of the game players are young kids that get the top scores. And here I was, and every time Nintendo Power Magazine printed the top scores for Game Boy Tetris, I had the top score that I would send them in a picture of. And it wasn't even a doctored picture. They got to where they said they wouldn't even print my name anymore because it had been in there too much, so I sent it in spelled backwards. Evitz is Steve backwards. Kainzau is Wozniak backwards. Evitz Kainzau. And I forgot that I had done it. So the next month when my Nintendo Power came, ripped it apart, and I turned to the back page and look at the top scores, and I'm looking to see if I'm in there, and I'm not in there. And there's a guy up there with a pretty good score, like 325,000, and I'm thinking, I remember having a 300-something. I think I had a, you know, one up there in 380. Did I have a high? Is he beating my highest score yet or not? I'm trying to figure out. And then I said it was a foreigner. His name's Evitz Kainzau. And then I still didn't figure it out, and I said, oh, my God, he's in the next city over, Saratoga. I changed the city so they wouldn't catch on. And then I finally remembered doing it, and I was thankful. Oh, good, it is me. So I like telling my kids I got the top score in Nintendo Power Magazine a few times, and how many dads can tell their kids that. And so if you ever find, it's probably in 1988, one of the issues of Nintendo Power Magazine has my name spelled backwards. And it was cool. I loved that Tetris so much. I got to give one to President Bush, the senior Bush, wrapped in red, white, and blue. And I actually presented one to him. Actually, my son did. And about a week later, he was in the hospital with a heart ailment. And they had him on TV and in a magazine playing Game Boy in bed in the hospital. So I was proud of that, and I gave another one to Gorbachev once wrapped in red because I had that kind of access. Well, I remember when you get your young kids, and my young kid that was going to be, you know, a gamer in life, his two goals in life were to either work for a game company or to work for a space company like NASA. And he just graduated from Carnegie Mellon in computer science, and he's working for NASA. So he lucked out. He lucked out. And I remember one time, you know, for an entire summer, he and a couple of friends were down in his room on his Macintosh computer every day, every minute until the night, the morning to night, taking charts of, they'd gotten some magazine or something that Nintendo sold that showed all the Mario characters in colors, and they would match the colors as best they could and putting together their own little color by color tiles for each of the Mario symbols. They spent so long on that sort of thing and learned a lot about perseverance, you know, and when you really care about something, it doesn't have to have value. It's just, you know, if you really care about it and you're an artist and a purist, that becomes, you know, the thing that you really want to do. Well, that's what's in you for life. And, yeah, I would say that game players and, you know, are a big threat. I mean, like, kind of like terrorists. Because we do things a lot for our love of them and for the spirit, and we do it for fun, and we don't do it for money. And we're challenging the system in the United States, which is, says that you do things for money. I think we have time for questions now, about 10 minutes for questions, so I'm gonna move on and open it up for questions, because there's tons of areas I haven't touched on. Yeah? Did they get the idea for the jog wheel on the iPod from the old breakout? No, I'm sure not. I'm sure not. There are other products in the world, too, with jog wheels. modern Bang & Olufsen phones and things like that. And, yeah. No questions? Make no questions, because I can always depart and talk to you individually. I'll be around. Yeah.
Yeah. After the Apple II, there's a huge gaming platform. You know, a lot of the gaming companies are migrated to the gaming market. That way, you can kind of maybe explain a little bit why Apple's a little bit more problematic.
I don't have a good reason why Apple dropped, let the game market slide away. We figured we were in it. It was third parties writing the games. An amazing thing happened. Between 1980 and 1983, Apple really ditched the Apple II, and you wouldn't know it. It was the largest selling computer in the world all those 3 years. It was until 1983 that the PC took over from us. It's the largest selling computer in the world, and Apple ditched it. There are no ads that show the Apple II, only the Apple III in those years. Everyone had an Apple III on their desk at Apple. So, but our impression in the world is Apple was the Apple II company. It's a very strange dichotomy. It's like they weren't in the real world. And why did Apple IIs keep selling so well? Because there were 200 companies out there selling games saying for the Apple II. So we had all the ads we wanted. It was really lucky that games plus hardware boards. But, yeah, why did Apple pull away from games? I don't know. I think it would have made a lot of sense to have a whole division oriented towards that way, because look where we're going now. Entertainment's back. But entertainment, of course, now, right now is music and movies and pictures. Right here?
What was your reaction to, like, the initial clones?
The initial clones of the Apple. There was a Franklin clone. And I was, you know, I'd heard from the lawyers that this was going on. I was involved in some very really important intellectual property lawsuits, the very earliest ones having to do with software copyrights and the like. But I heard there were clones. And then one day at Apple, I saw one. And it was this Franklin computer. They had laid out our PC board, copied the PC board exactly with a Xerox machine, put the exact same chips in the exact same position. And, I mean, it's not like they even copied the circuit. They just copied the layout. And I was just shocked. So I saw it at a show at CES, or no, some computer show. I walked up to the Franklin booth, and I started talking to their president, and I said, you know, this is basically, you know, how could you do this? And the press is gathering around, and I said, you know, well, don't you design your own stuff? I mean, I'm your chief engineer. You know, you should at least call me your chief engineer. So I said, yes, you're our chief engineer. That was their legal point, was they had a right to copy it. And I walked away. I walked away, because that was all I could think to say, but I should have said, then give me a salary. I grew up thinking that engineers were the most honest people in the world, because they dealt with facts and calculations and things that always worked out one precise way, and it wasn't a subjective life, and that they were, that you'd learn to design things, so why do you copy? Why would an engineer copy? So that was kind of a learning experience for me in life. Yeah. Oh.
They had my name in.
Yeah, but Yeah, they said they had the right. Yeah, but there were a lot of clones all around the world. I get email to this day from people in places like Bulgaria talking about the Apple II clones they had over there. So it's kind of neat to see. But I remember when I was traveling the Soviet Union once, finally got a book that had a chip in it. I'd wanted to in any bookstore, any one book, and it had a chip, and it was the exact same pinouts as a 74-166 from Texas Instruments. And the driver said, oh, yeah, we invented that here in the Soviet Union. So, yeah. Yes? I think in terms of just big numbers and eventual, Apple is often trying to look to the future, and I think we dropped the Apple II way, way too early and too strongly inside. And just turned it into, you know, the only guy on the paycheck that was doing any Apple II work was the guy reprinting the price list. Then that happened too often. But, you know, eventually, sometimes we got corrections. And we had ditched the Apple II, and we actually came back to it with the Apple II GS. So, and nothing, you know, theoretically lasts forever. Changes form and all. Yeah.
What do you think of the Apple IIc? It's like the kind of closed form factor versus the open.
Okay. Yeah. The Apple IIc was a small little, carry it like today's laptop size machines, still had to be plugged in the wall, though. And you could buy a little LCD attachment for it from another company. This Apple IIc was just like a real thin, small Apple II. Peter Quist was the program manager, and it's sort of sad that he died in later years. But I loved it. That was my favorite Apple II of all time, the size, because I like small things that you kind of hold in your hand. I don't like it. You know, the smaller they are, the better, up to a point. And I loved that machine. I could carry it on airplanes. I did most of my programming and work on it for many, many years. Yeah, that was my favorite one ever. You could buy an Applied Engineering card and plug it in. You had CPM inside of your Apple IIc, and you had extra memory to boot. I mean, it was a beautiful little machine. So, yeah. Do I have any of my early schematics? I probably do, but probably not findable. I have so many disorganized boxes of history, it's just almost impossible to find anything. And I just sort of throw things in a box. Even big major awards, I don't even know where they are. I couldn't even tell you where my National Medal of Technology Award is, because to me, showing somebody an award isn't that important as having it. And having it's not as important as having earned it. Having earned it isn't even as important as having learned some good stuff to be able to. So, you know, I don't know where all my stuff is. That's why I've never done a book to this day. But I hope to. When I do a book, they're going to be shocked, because it's going to be more shocking prank stories than anything else.
What are you cooking up now?
What am I cooking up now? I'm working on. So actually, I'm interested right now in engineering again. Not engineering, but per se, but a little startup company building some GPS products, because GPS is so cheap and so applicable to so many areas of life. And but I'm not talking about it because we're not quite out with any technology yet, and we're going to license it so other companies will really sell it. And we're doing it in Los Gatos. It's a lot of fun. Yeah. Yes. I was real proud that the Apple II, I counted the chips, and even though they had left tons and tons of things out of the Commodore and the Atari, they had still done a good job on their design and got the chips down to about the same as the Apple II. So I figured that our cost to manufacture was the lowest, at least for a complete system, especially when you used your home TV for free, and they had to build in a little monitor. So we had the lowest cost to build, but we really wanted to price a very high profit so that we could have enough revenues to build a company and not blow up before we got there. And that was really a lot of the thinking on how to run a company didn't come from myself and Steve Jobs. It came from an experienced person with us that owned a third of the company, owned an equal amount of the company. Mike Marklow was his name. Do I play lots of games today? I have very little time. Email just has nailed me. I have tons of people contacting me from all over the world. I'm in a lot of traveling, speaking events. I get invited to at least one a day. I don't have much time, but anytime I have free time, I play games right now, computer games, and I play Tetris. Oh, I go to every concert at Shoreline Amphitheater since it started, and the entire concert I play Tetris with a friend linked with him on the Game Boy, so I still do that. And whenever we see people, we all make up all these BS stories about how, yeah, the world championships, I'm the world champion, and they have the championships every year, and it's a few a few hundred thousand bucks. Sometimes you can get $600,000 for winning it. And the only time I lost was 1993 to a 14-year-old girl in Pennsylvania. Yeah, I've got the story down, but I still play that. I don't get to the Defender as often as I used to in the house, and I play on the computer just things like simple normal games, hearts, spades, and snood. I got very good at snood. I like that one a lot. And gosh, there's one other game. Spite and Malice, a game I was taught recently. It's a card game. Yeah. So I do play. And my free time could be as much as 10 hours in some days, and the other days it could be zero. RF adapter story for the Apple II. When we came out the Apple II, there was no way into TV sets. There was no video in. So how are we going to get there? We had to broadcast Channel 3, and I was very scared to build a transmitter because my ham radio background and my ethics said that you protect the airwaves and you don't build transmitters that will muck up signals. And there was no specification to tell how much can you put out, how much energy can you put out that's legal or not. So I wouldn't let Apple build the RF modulator, and they kind of went around me and just got this guy Marty Spergel to build a modulator and give him our shipment list and tell him how many to ship everywhere. So another company besides Apple built the modulator, you know, and it was a few years actually, 2 or 3 years before there was a law for the specification type 2B or whatever the category is. And TV sets came out. TV sets have video in now anyway, and besides we passed up NTSC eventually. Yeah. Did I have any input into the iPod? The answer is no. 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 I was real happy to see it though. What was it like to be part of a Disney attraction? That's a good question, since I didn't know it. It wouldn't mean anything. Wouldn't be what? It sounds cool. It sounds cool. I hope they made me a good guy. Because you know what people say. You sometimes they like to say you're smart and you're good, and I say, well, I'm not that smart, but I'm good. Where'd the name Apple come from? I picked up Steve Jobs at the airport. He had just come back from Oregon Orchards, and driving him down Highway 85, and we're in Los Altos, and he comes up with, I got a name for the company. And he came up with Apple Computer. And at first I said, what about Apple Records? And he says, well, it's a big deal. So assume that doesn't matter. But seriously, the both of us, I don't pry, so I don't ever ask, where'd you come up with it? So I don't really know the origins. In many things that he said in later years, I would talk to somebody who had told him the things that I had heard, and then I knew where it had come from. He's secretive and doesn't tell where the ideas come from. I assumed in my own head, maybe they have apple trees in this orchard in Oregon. And both of us tried to think of real technical-sounding names for a company, but they were just too blah compared to Apple, so that was real lucky that we went with it. And when we got our first ad agency, when we became a real company with the Apple II, that was when they wanted to design a logo for us. You know, so they put, we wanted six colors because we had color. That's why we had a color logo. And they designed it in rainbow order, and Steve had to, you know, get the darker colors to the bottom so it's not quite rainbow order. Yeah. Pirates of Silicon Valley. Had no idea that any of us, they didn't interview any of the principals in that movie. They wouldn't talk to anybody in advance for their research. And a friend of mine, Andy Hertzfeld, got a bootleg tape of it a month before it was going to be shown on TV. And he said, oh, you're in it as like a narrator. Oh my God, what a surprise. Well, I still don't watch, I don't read Apple books because most of them, I read very few because unless somebody tells me there's something good there, because usually they're just so far off base and it just offends me and I don't like to read all the business talk stories anyway. So I wasn't going to watch this movie, but my wife wanted to watch it one night and we put it on the TV and I'm sitting there on my computer and the opening scene on just grabbed me. And I thought that my personality was very well represented, you know, or at least some good things I've done, including, you know, basically trying to get stock to the employees instead of to some big financial guys on the outside, and you know, and our humble startings, you know, running with a blue box through tear gas in Berkeley, man, that was as real as could be. So I loved that movie, grabbed me right from the start, and I liked it. Every scene in there was an event that really happened, not necessarily portrayed accurately in terms of who was there. The third-level personalities were portrayed very differently than the real people are, and what points in time or dates they occurred. But generally, what they meant, the whole movie, scene by scene by scene, was fairly accurate as far as they were events, and they did have that meaning. That was my opinion of the movie. Yeah. I don't want to talk about the breakout issue. Yeah.
You mentioned seeing Francis at Shoreline. Have you seen that Van Halen's current tour? And what do you think of David Lee?
I've seen, well, I started Shoreline Amphitheater, and I've seen every concert there in about, since it started 17 years ago or so, and except when I'm out of town. And Van Halen's latest tour, so I go to so many concerts locally, I don't have time to add a few more concerts to my schedule that aren't there. So I haven't seen Van Halen's latest, and all I remember is at the US Festival. Yeah, at the US Festival, I had Van Halen headline once, so I got to meet his wife, Valerie Bertinelli. US Festival on DVD, no. I was really taken advantage of. I didn't know the music business well, and I had very limited rights to anything. The only group that had rights to keep material from the US Festival was Triumph, and they did come out with a DVD this year. I get a ton of requests and email for, will you ever have a DVD? I mean, we got all the videos of everything, but just don't have the rights. Somebody would have to go back and clear them all to make an US Festival DVD. I think it'd be a great thing, but, well, it's better to have done it. I enjoyed it. Okay, thank you. We're a little over time, so we're breaking now. Thanks.